You're back with GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Hello, Bob.
Chris, good to be with you.
Great to have you back. Volatility in the markets, lots of uncertainty. Reading over the columns, Walmart closing down 250 stores, 150 in the United States. That's 3 stores per state, mostly peripheral stores, not their supercenters, getting out of the grocery business incrementally. It's a retail apocalypse, they're calling it. I've been telling all my subscribers now to the Alpha Stocks newsletter to buy Amazon shares for years. They're obviously a component here, but what else is going on in this retail apocalypse?
Yeah, I think on the Walmart, who knows that Walmart itself may have been maturing, but an outstanding company for so long, and maybe the old threads are gone, but I think their number one error was when they decided to go to minimum wages, and they couldn't press their suppliers enough. It was an improbable move, probably contributing to their contraction. But, you know, capitalism is the way. It takes out the old services or systems and new ones come along, as you said, with Amazon. But perhaps the retail bubble is over. Perhaps the secondary bubble in real estate is maturing. I saw one last night that Hong Kong real estate peaked in August, and prices on an index and have come down quite remarkably. It looks like the blow-off has concluded, and that followed the blow-off in the Shanghai stock market in June. So if you, and perhaps Hong Kong is reflecting maybe much of Asia in residential values. So I think the world has been playing in bubbles again. You had they called it the worst calamity since the 1930s, and that concluded in March 2009. I believe that it concluded naturally. Policymakers believe they ended it, the contraction, and prompted this expansion. So they then got on the mode of extreme ease because, first of all, they thought that the panic would last forever. And then, of course, because the economic expansion determined by GDP was not up to their arbitrary standard, they then kept pushing the financial markets. And I always like to point out that it's the public that chooses what will be speculated in. And they chose to speculate in low-grade bonds and the stock market. They did not choose to speculate in commodities or precious metals, which bear market after 2011. The bear market's been on since 2011. So this has always fascinated me, Chris, that the central bank is a one-trick pony. All it can do is ease credit. So you went through this 1970s where the credit ease went into extreme inflation in wages, CPI, commodities, and then the whole street said, oh, this is it, the Fed's evil, it'll inflate forever, and commodities and precious metals will go up forever. Of course, that was in the market, 1980-81 blow-off in commodity prices, and at the same time a blow-off in interest rates at highs, the long-dated treasury up to 15%. And in Canada, long governments got up to 19%. So then the blowout in commodities crashed, just like 1920 and 21, and it set up an era of financial bubbles. If you look at the money supply figures in late 70s and into the early 80s, and of course the legend is that Paul Volcker personally ended inflation, but if you look at the money supply figures, they didn't stop growing, continued to grow. You had a terrific crash in commodities. And then beginning in 1982, you started a terrific bull market in financial assets, just like the 1920s. So then you had a number of peaks there. You know, of course, the one in 2000 with the tech and dot-com bubble, but it didn't have all the characteristics of a great financial bubble such as in 1929 or 1873. And then that appeared in the peak in 2007, and the consequence was, and the establishment said that it was the worst calamity since the 1930s. So then, just to put the perspective on where we are now, is that the rebound is on financial markets was the first bull market out of a classic crash, and the recovery, such as it has been, is the first business cycle out of a classic crash. And the business cycle is probably matured in the summer. And looking at automobile sales in the U.S. and, as I said, the housing market in Hong Kong and other things, it looks like a global recession is starting. And in the U.S., of course, the National Bureau of Economic Research sets the beginning and end of each recession. And they're usually they're not a predictive organization, so they always look over the shoulder. And oftentimes they've decided and announced the start of the recession a year after it actually started. So the only mystery is when will the NBER decide the recession and what date will they say it started. I would guess maybe September or something like that. So anyways, I think we're in the next contraction, and definitely on credit side, it's getting very sticky out there. Credit spreads have been widening, particularly since June, when the reversal came into widening, and that's always a bad sign. And then on our model, what we were looking for is by the end of July that the second technical breakout to widening would have been accomplished. But that took place in the first week in August, close enough. And, of course, that pushed off the Shanghai problem, which then fed into the rest of the world, commodity prices and all that sort of stuff. So this is a bad sign when you've got chronically weak commodity prices. But to get back to the theme, Chris, is that the Fed has been the easiest in its history, and it doesn't get economic growth. They talk about an employment number that they like, but they always overlook the 30 or 40 million people that are no longer looking for jobs. So the economic number or the employment number is nonsense. So the instruction on this one will be, and I think the public will figure it out before the policymakers do, is that it's a lot of nonsense, because while they may ease, and their theory is that easy credit drives business activity, we've seen that easy credit does not drive business activity, but it drives speculation. And it did drive speculation in commodities for whatever reason. So I think the public is on the verge of a great discovery of common sense when it comes to policymaking, and it's going to be very interesting. So this is where we're watching the financial markets here. Recently, the S&P or the Dow, whichever you want to look at, became very oversold and set up a bounce. On our work, we figured it would last about 2 weeks, and it also would make a 38% Fibonacci retracement. Well, close to 2 weeks and close to, and a bit higher, I think, than the 38%, but nonetheless, those are the numbers we were looking at. And the actual inside number, I think, was an 8 trading day rally, and that ended a couple of days ago. So, yeah, this next sell-off could be scary. And whether it holds at the lows earlier in January, who knows?
A lot going on in the markets. I mean, we've seen considerable improvement in the precious metals. We saw the yellow metal bounce nearly $100 from its nadir a couple of months ago. It seems counterintuitive, though, because the Federal Reserve raised rates for the first time in nearly a decade, and now they have plans to raise rates again. However, they've thrown a wrench into the mix lately. They've gotten nervous. Apparently, they started to recognize what the rest of us have seen for almost a year, that Europe is in trouble. Earthquake in the economic foundations of Asia. Central bankers are lowering rates in a negative territory. We just heard last week, Shinzo Abe is dropping, you know, their rates into negative territory following the economic ministers in Europe. So this is uncharted territory. And the Fed fund futures are now reflecting this sea change event. The Fed's only going to raise one more time.
The central bankers of around the world have all taken the same economics degrees. They have PhDs in currency depreciation and interest rate manipulation. And it's not been working. I think that they've given up on trying to save the world, and all they're trying to do is prove that their bogus theories are working. And the idea that the Fed is going to raise interest rates four times is absolute nonsense. The market has been raising interest rates since January last year. The yield on long-dated treasuries has been going up. Since June of 2014, interest rates on junk bonds have been rising and rising substantially. And the work I've done on financial history is that when you're in bubble land, the changes by the senior central bank on their administered rates have been 5 or 6 months behind what's been going on in market rates of interest. That's either up in yield or down in yield. So the focus that the Fed is getting is misspent. I wouldn't pay any attention to it at all. I would watch market rates of interest, and particularly the credit spreads, the difference between long-dated treasuries and junk bonds. There's more to be learned there than anything that the central bankers would say. So you won't get me to comment on it other than to tell people to ignore it.
Certainly looked as though it was baked into the cake, the economic cake in the markets, that we would see higher rates, but they're backpedaling now.
Chris, they may be backpedaling, but our forecast is that interest rates, particularly for lower grade stuff, junk bonds, are going to continue to rise, whether the Fed does anything with the administered rate or not. That's the one that's baked in the cake. Market rates of interest are going to go up. Now, also, one way of looking at it is that there was such a speculative party in junk bonds, so it was an asset price that got inflated to the moon, and you know what happens to asset prices after that. They go down. In the case is the asset is a bond, yields go up. And then also, long-dated treasuries had a very good speculative run, so the long bond became an asset price that became quite inflated. And, of course, market forces will eventually deflate those bonds. So long-dated treasuries going up does not mean that the economy is going to go up or commodities are going to go up. It would be a complete bond revulsion whereby the world begins to reject owning any bond whatsoever, and particularly on low-grade credits, and then that feeds into the long treasuries. So we're not bullish on long-dated government bonds, and the yields will likely go up, and the Federal Reserve will likely follow them up. So I don't accept this business that the Fed's going to raise rates four times, and then, of course, here recently they're not. Well, you had a brief little rest in the yields in long bonds and in long junk. So, no, the Fed is merely along for the ride.
Some of our leading guests, like yourself, have gone on record noting that they believe the bottom is in on the yellow metal and that we should expect a resumption of the bull market. Do you suspect then, if that's the case, that investors now will get over their concern about rates and focus more in the direction of market fear, volatility, uncertainty?
Yeah, well, the view we have is that, of course, you want to own some gold for protection. It's an insurance. But to make money out of gold in U.S. dollar terms, one of the problems you have in a post-bubble environment is that the senior currency becomes chronically strong relative to most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. And so those who are living in countries with the worst currencies have made money in gold. Those in U.S. terms haven't made any money in gold. As a matter of fact, since 2011, it's gone down hugely. So we try and avoid the conversation about trying to make money out of in gold in U.S. dollar terms. Instead, we advise people to look at it, the sector, as an investment, whereby in a post-bubble deflation, the cost of mining go down. That mining cost includes the cost of energy, and if you notice that crude oil has fallen hugely relative to gold. So in previous post-bubble deflations, this has been the case, and you get gold's real price going up, and profitability comes back into the miners, and you make money as an investor in the stock. And you can have this happen as in the early 1930s, where the price of gold was fixed at $20.67 an ounce. And once the 1929 crash was over, the real price increased. And, for example, Homestake stock by the end of 1932, this was before Roosevelt fooled around with the price. So there was no change in the price, and the stock was up something like 135% when the rest of the market was in the tank, and their earnings had improved by around 130%. So this is where we focus on the real price and profitability for the mining operators. And so if you're having a prosperity returning to gold mining, people will be looking for expiration stocks and all that sort of thing. So we think we're close to the start of a new bull market for gold shares based upon a continued rise in gold's real price and an improving operating margins. This does not pay any attention to speculation about where the price of gold will go in U.S. dollar terms.
We typically see, of course, the XAU, HUI, and related precious metals shares indices lead the metals higher. This time around, we might see more of a disconnect.
At some point, you know, of course, in the bull market to 2011, the big ones like Barrick and the stuff we're doing, they were in the wrong places politically, the wrong places as far as terrain goes, and then the wrong kind of geology, where it was awkward metallurgy. So the whole thing became a disaster. So once all of the disasters are written off and you've got good, sound operations going on, as the real price continues to improve for gold, the operating margins will improve, and then the whole thing. Oh, in previous post-bubble deflations, gold has become the premier place to be. Gold mining is outstanding. And you don't have to have the price going up in U.S. dollar terms, or going back even further in sterling when it was the senior currency. Who knows? The U.S. goes back onto a gold standard. Then there's no speculation in the price of gold at all, but there will be investment returns to be made out of the rising real price. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it will happen. That's because already in the last year you've had a terrific rise in the real price relative to the key commodities such as energy prices as represented by crude oil. And also, when you've had such a disaster in base metal mining, you've got you know, they can, you can get tires again for the moving equipment. And also, there's a lid on wages when you have a whole lot of base metal miners out of work, and you got to go operating gold mining that's doing well. So prospects, the outlook for the gold mining sector is a new bull market. The only thing that's questionable at the moment is actually when does it start? And, of course, our technical side looks after that. And we bought a few gold stocks for the first time in a long time a couple of months ago. And then when the latest decline came in, we said this is setting up another opportunity to accumulate some gold stocks. So it becomes an investment world, Chris, rather than speculation and price changes in gold.
Well, that's, I think, the best policy for the overwhelming majority of investors. I had a listener the other day send over his opinion about day trading. I said, you know, one of the best ways to accumulate $1 million in an account is to begin day trading with $1 billion.
I like that one.
I can't stress enough the importance of long-term investing. So as we wrap up here, let's tell folks a bit more about Institutional Advisors, please.
You can find us under that, institutionaladvisors.com, or you can just Google my name. It's easy, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, and it all comes up into our introduction and into our website.
Very good. A copy of Institutional Advisors on everybody's desktop must have. Bob Hoy, we thank you.
Very good, Chris. Anytime. Look forward to it.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.